It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why polka is such an enduring part of the Midwest's musical landscape.
First, Congress may be closing the door on its last budget face-off with President Obama. Late last night, congressional leaders released a two-year budget plan negotiated by Democrats and Republicans that would raise the borrowing limit and increase spending by $8 million.
The deal would avert a debt default that the Treasury Department said would happen by November 3rd. It also clears the way for likely Speaker-to-be Paul Ryan to focus on issues other than the debt ceiling as he prepares to lead the House. Here with us to talk about the budget deal is Paul Singer, Washington correspondent at USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, a budget deal, how and who? How did this happen?
Well, it has been underway for a couple of months, very quietly. Leadership in the House and the Senate, bipartisan leadership in the House and the Senate, have been meeting with the White House trying to work out a deal. And it was very clear that John Boehner, who is departing as Speaker of the House, wanted to, as he says, clean out the barn, get a bunch of stuff done before he leaves at the end of this week, and your own Wisconsin's Paul Ryan becomes the next Speaker.
And was that a key to this deal, that Boehner was on the way out so he didn't have anything to lose? He didn't have to fear any punishment?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, one of the keys to the deal is that, you know, Boehner has nothing to lose. He is able to basically put together a package that a majority of Democrats will support, possibly even all of them, and enough minority of the Republicans will support to get the bill passed. And it buys 2 years. The way this deal is structured, the major components, that is, budget targets and debt ceiling, are both extended for a couple of years. And so, you know, the next Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, doesn't have to grapple over these issues starting fresh out the gate.
Yeah, right. How many times have we talked over the last couple of years about the next upcoming debt ceiling deadline? It gets bumped back a couple months here, 6 months
right there.
This time, if this passes, we'll go a couple years without that conversation?
Yeah, and smartly, they've actually suspended the debt ceiling until March 2017, meaning that they get it past the elections entirely, and Congress will have to grapple with this thing essentially the furthest they will ever be from an election, you know, 20 months before an actual election. So that's about as good as it gets.
So what are the key details in this budget as it exists now?
Oh, I wish I knew. I mean, the short version is there will be about $80 billion in increased spending that's divided between defense and non-defense programs. The whole issue here has been that we've been operating under what they call the sequester, these sort of government-wide spending caps that have become just too restrictive. The Republicans wanted more spending on defense. The Democrats wanted more spending on domestic programs. They basically split the baby. They added $80 billion and said half for each over the next 2 years. The other thing it did that's really sort of interesting is there's a more or less a technical change to Social Security, where they're moving some money out of the Social Security Trust Fund to cover a shortfall or a pending shortfall in Social Security disability. And this is being sort of marked by Republicans as their great victory in this deal, that they get the first major reform to Social Security in 30 years. There's some changes in disability qualifications, a little more strict, particularly on disability applications. So they're saying, we have won something in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. Well, the Democrats, of course, are saying debt ceiling was a totally separate thing. There was no negotiation about that at all.
And Democrats were worried about changes to that Social Security disability benefit. I've seen some quotes from some of those Democrats saying, it's not so bad.
Right. Right. In fact, yesterday, when this thing first emerged, there was some immediate outrage on the left, like, oh, you can't, you know, balance the budget on the backs of our seniors. But having now looked at it again, they said, well, you know, all things considered, this is not bad. But I think ultimately they would argue they want bigger benefits, not smaller. But this is also not the grand deal. I mean, the longer-term conversation that still has to go on at some point is the growth of entitlements is still going to be bankrupting us. It's just over the next couple of years, they figured out a way to declare a small victory.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about this new budget deal reached by congressional leaders. Let's get to some of the reaction here. Now, this, as you say, it's been going on for a while. It was the leadership, future likely leadership. Paul Ryan has been among those saying, I don't know about the deal, but I don't like the process. Has that been a common theme in some of the reactions you've been seeing?
Yes, although, I mean, even John Boehner today gave a press conference where he said, I didn't like the process either. You know, this is not the way we're supposed to govern. But given the circumstances we were in, there was really no choice. Some of the Democrats today made fun of Paul Ryan, saying, hey, this is basically the same process he engaged in a couple of years ago when we had the last fiscal cliff deal. Again, you go behind closed doors, you do a little bit of horse trading, you drop it on your colleagues with no time to argue, and that has to pass. That's kind of the way Congress works. Now, Ryan is swearing it won't be that way under Speaker Ryan, but we shall see.
Easier said than done, it sounds like.
Correct.
And now how about the Freedom Caucus, the group people point to for John Boehner's downfall as Speaker? Are they going to support this thing? Are they going to oppose it? If they oppose it, are they going to be enough to scuttle it?
I don't think they'll be enough to scuttle it. They will definitely oppose it. They'll oppose it both on the grounds that it raises spending and on the grounds that the process was lousy. I don't think at this point there'll be enough of them to scuttle it because all the Democrats are going to support it. But it is, I think, telling that they're going to try and have this vote before they vote for the Speaker of the House. They don't want, that is, you know, Boehner and the Republicans who are backing this deal don't want this to be something that Paul Ryan has to get bloodied over. They'd like this to be done out of the way before he takes the gavel.
Now, what about all the objections over Planned Parenthood and the federal budget? Is this just not a part of this and not an issue right now?
It's not in this conversation. Now, I will say that the way this works, this is a budget agreement. It is not actually all the spending bills. The spending bills, the reason this was critical is that you have to sort of set the levels for where the spending bills will be, and this is what the bill does. The spending bill still has to be finished by the end of December, or middle of December, and there's still a possibility for arguments over stuff like that, the policy riders that don't actually change the number. So we'll see when that comes back around, but for the time being, that is not part of the conversation today.
Well, but with the debt ceiling fixed until, as you said, I think spring of 2017, does that mean these arguments will not include the word shutdown?
It does not, actually.
Oh.
You could still shut the government down. In theory, come December, an argument could still ensue over some provision that says, you know, thou shalt not spend any money on Planned Parenthood, or you know, pick your topic. And you could come to a showdown where they fail to pass or refuse to pass some portion of the spending bills over that policy dispute, and that would conceivably shut the government down, or at least whatever portion of it they're arguing over. We'll see. I don't think anybody wants to do that this time around, and that's why they are getting this budget deal passed, but it is plausible.
And finally, Paul, this agreement, again, if it passes, does it take some of these issues, the debt ceiling, things like that, off of the presidential political trail, maybe issues that nobody was sure they could win on?
Yeah, we'll find out on Wednesday night, of course, because the Republicans will have another debate. And at that debate, which is all about economics, we can expect some discussion of why this proves that, you know, I don't know, somebody did something wrong, and why the next president will be better. It certainly doesn't give them any opportunity to sort of stand in the way of progress, as it were, but it does give them something they can yell about being done badly.
Paul, thanks. Always good to talk to you.
My pleasure. Have a great day, Rob.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, Washington correspondent at USA Today, about the federal budget deal announced last night. We'll be right back.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Many ethnic traditions have their own musical styles and dances, but the polka is one that's shared by many groups, or maybe claimed by many groups, is closer to the truth.
Joining us now to talk about polka's place in the Midwest is Rick March, a folklorist and musician. Rick has participated in the Midwest polka scene for more than three decades. He's the author of Polka Heartland, Why the Midwest Loves to Polka. Rick, thanks for coming back again.
Yeah, thanks for asking me in.
Well, we just heard an excerpt there of Frankie Yankovic playing the Pennsylvania Polka, which is a well-known tune, especially for people who have seen the movie Groundhog Day. But let's start with the basics here. What makes a polka a polka?
Well, a polka is a dance in 2/4 time that has a particular lilt that's good for dancing the polka to. A polka is a polka. It's just another polka.
And is there always an accordion involved in this?
The accordion is quite prominent, but there are many styles of polka bands that do not include accordion or any kind of a squeeze box.
Now, I associate polka with the Polish side of my family. I know it's not exclusively or even necessarily originally Polish. Can you talk about the ethnic makeup of the polka world?
Well, what I pointed out in the Polka Heartland book, it's possible to do historical research using the new databases that enables you to find stuff that it would have taken years to track down in archives before. So I was able to find, for example, the earliest mentions in the London and New York newspapers of when polka dances were, staged and advertised. And it was in the 1840s. And actually, the polka was a pop culture craze. Mm-hmm. It was not any particular ethnic group's dance. There's a mythology in the polka world that gets amplified by the internet now that, oh yes, a certain Czech servant girl on a certain day in the 1830s invented the dance, and her boss saw her doing it and wrote it down. I don't know what kind of dance notation he knew, but he wrote it down, and then once it was written down, then it spread all over the place. But in any case, it was really mainstream culture initially in the United States in the 1840s through the 1860s. During the Civil War, there was rail splitter polka dedicated to Abe Lincoln, and the Confederates had, secession polka and things of that nature. And as in all pop culture crazes, as it started to die down by the 1870s, that also happened to be the time that there was massive immigration from Central and Eastern Europe, and the polka was popular in their home country. So the people, continued to think of it as part of their community's ethnic culture, and it has remained so now 170 years. It's kind of amazing. I don't know how many dances, can say that they've been around. Maybe the waltz is the only one that's around longer.
Now, you said that the popularity kind of ebbs and flows. You mentioned a couple of high points there. So tell us a little bit about what those moments were like when polka was the thing to do, when it was a craze.
Second polka craze came about exactly 100 years after the first one, right after World War II, and that's when Frankie Yankovic launched his career. He, had a million seller with Just Because, and it was a situation where, in the immediate post-war years, there was kind of an exhilaration. It fit into the national mood. The big rock and roll craze hadn't hit yet, so there was about a decade where they didn't have competition from rock and roll. And, it was the thing to do.
One of the favorite things I learned in your book was, I think it was in the initial 1840s craze, there was an anti-polka reaction, people saying this is immoral. This is a craze that's sweeping and degrading the people.
Yeah. Well, the similar reaction there was also to rock and roll and so forth. And it was kind of the lambada of its day. It was, the waltz had actually had shock value initially because it wasn't like a minuet or a quadrille where you were just touching your pinkies, but actually there was a man and a woman with, you know, arms around each other. And when the waltz began to lose its shock value after a couple of decades, then along came the polka, which they're still, you know, dancing in a couple like that, but now frenetically hopping up and down instead of gliding smoothly in the waltz. So yeah, it was Queen Victoria forbade that the polka be danced in her presence.
We're talking with Rick March right now. He's a folklorist and musician, and he's got a new book out. It's called Polka Heartland, Why the Midwest Loves to Polka. So let's zoom in on the Midwest here. Why is polka such a hot topic here in the Midwest, and especially Wisconsin? Why is Wisconsin a hot spot for the polka?
Yeah, Wisconsin's right in the middle of polka territory, and we have a lot of bands in this state, and we have a wide variety of styles. I put out a couple of CDs for Smithsonian Folkways, one called Deep Polka and the other one Deeper Polka, and they featured seven different ethnic styles, all from Wisconsin on Deep Polka, that didn't exhaust them. So basically, I think it's because in the Midwest, ethnicity has remained a part of our consciousness. Even if you're mixed, you know, you said the Polish side of my family, you know, I'm mixed too, but, you know, I will think about, oh yeah, the Croatian side of my family. So there are things that people do. There are foods they eat. There's even, you know, card games you play. You play sheep's head maybe if you're German-American, you know, but if you instead you play euchre if you're Scandinavian. You know, there's things, you know, ethnicity plays a big part in life. And also there's just a, you know, unlike the bi-coastal zones, the Midwest culture isn't like we have to be cutting edge. You know, we can, you know, stick with heritage. We can have a polka, a dance that has, you know, some longevity at a wedding, because maybe it'll lend longevity to that marriage. You know, who knows? So the Midwest has, because of the ethnic connections and because of this kind of a sense of heritage being strong in the region. Those are the main reasons.
Well, UW Marching Band, Tuba Heavy, institutionalized the polka. Let's give a listen. So you hear this at every UW Anything game, pretty much. Featured, I didn't know this, on a Budweiser commercial back in the 70s, the UW Marching Band?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Isn't that something? I don't know. Anheuser-Busch got the Badger Band away from the Milwaukee, brewing companies. Who knows? I don't know exactly how that commercial came about, but certainly they continue to play that as the Bud song. And, you know, there's the fifth quarter. Well, actually, the tuba circle the field playing a Roll Out the Barrel in, I don't know, is it the third quarter maybe? And people try to polka a little bit between the benches, during the fifth quarter.
Not enough room there.
So the cheerleaders are doing it down on the field. Yeah, I think the thing about it is whether you're into polka particularly or not, it's one of the symbols of, you know, us. You know, we do it. You know, it's just, yeah, it reminds me of my dad or my grandpa. You know, it's you may not dance it for years, but then you go to that wedding, and even if it's a modern wedding with a DJ, you know, he's got that polka record to put on at a certain point, you know, during the wedding dance. And it's remained a part of the tradition, and I just felt it was long overdue for there to be a book that was addressed to the general public that took a broad general approach to polka.
Now, Rick, you said that the polka is intergenerational, and yet I think a lot of us associate the polka with sort of an older generation, maybe a slightly different time of life. So are there younger people who are keeping on with this polka tradition and keeping it alive?
Yeah, there are great photographs, especially the ones from Pulaski Polka days, of the younger dancers and musicians in the book. Not every polka scene is thriving. You know, some scenes are dying out. You just see a lot of gray hair on the floor. But other scenes are thriving. And it always has been music of immigrant and ethnic communities. And, you know, we mustn't overlook that now Latinos are the major immigrant group that enjoys polka. Mexico had the polka come in from Europe, much as it came into the United States in the 19th century. And, you know, when you hear that... that pickup truck with the Virgin of Guadalupe on the rear windshield blasting their sound system going bop, bop, bop. That's a polka. So we did have some pictures from a Mexican dance. The Polish scene is very strong. In some communities, it will die down. It'll never die out. There seems to be, even in the scenes where everybody's got gray hair on the floor, there are younger people who are taking up playing the music.
And I want to, you've got your accordion, and to give you a chance to pick that up, I want to listen briefly to one of those younger bands, the Brave Combo, with the classic Who Stole the Kishka?
Let's polka!
Rick, that was a listen there to a younger polka band, and now we're going to hear the real thing live in studio. What are you going to take us out with here?
Oh, boy. I don't know. Let's see. How about a little bit of the Barbara Polka on my button box accordion?
All right.
Keep going, Rick. That's Rick March, folklorist and musician. He's the author of the new book, Polka Heartland, Why the Midwest Loves to Polka. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. There were over 28,000 reported cases of domestic abuse in Wisconsin in 2012, the latest data available. 71% of those incidences included an arrest.
Our next guest says that while many people might consider domestic violence to be mainly a personal issue, it's actually also a political issue. She says policies can be put into place to help protect victims of domestic violence.
Kathleen Arnold joins us now. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University. She's been researching issues of poverty, race, and gender for more than 15 years. Her latest book is called Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why do you say that domestic abuse is a political problem?
I mean, one way to make a comparison is kind of like saying with racism, for example, you could experience interpersonal sort of racist incidents, but there's a larger spread out there or a larger kind of power matrix of racism that you can kind of map that personal interaction onto. And I think we should do the same with domestic violence. We shouldn't see it merely as personal or private, but something that's systematic that affects a great number of women. And for which a lot of perhaps shelters, police, and policymakers could perhaps do a better job on.
What do you think happens when, as a society, we see domestic abuse as a personal thing between two partners instead of as a broader issue in society?
Honestly, I think we make a lot of mistakes. And one of the things I think about quite a lot is some of the stories of my friends who have thought they could report domestic abuse and were surprised to find out that they were arrested, for example, and not the people who assaulted, you know, their partners who assaulted them.
Ray, let's talk about that. I mean, for one thing, you list in your piece, you talk about the story of Ray Rice, I think he was the NFL player who was caught on camera attacking his wife. And I didn't know this, but they were both arrested apparently after that.
Right, and dual arrest is actually the kind of go-to policy in about 23 states, although there's a movement to arrest the primary aggressor, so it's like called the primary aggressor, like kind of noting that dual arrest has not had the effect it's supposed to have. But can you imagine being Janelle Rice, having all of America watch that happen, and then knowing she was arrested?
What is the policy behind that practice of dual arrest?
I think I've heard a couple of things or seen it, you know, through my research. And one is that the police don't really want to get involved, that it's up to a judge to sort it out, for example. Another thing is like a sort of misguided gender equality that I have to say I'm absolutely fascinated with. When we make a situation equal that's not equal, that the woman must have done something, this kind of two to tango mentality.
So sort of it takes two to cause trouble, takes two to fight. Is that what's sort of underpinning the philosophy there?
One would think, and then a third philosophy I've heard, although it's more, you know, academic, I think, is that it actually protects the woman. But you have the arrest on your record. If you're an immigrant, you could be put into deportation proceedings because of this. So it's a pretty serious thing to have happen. It's also traumatic to be arrested after you were attacked.
So how would it protect the woman, just in that she's separated from the person she was being abused by?
That's one argument I've heard. I don't know how prevalent it is. I think it's more the gender equality and the police not wanting to, you know, they don't want to be psychologists. They don't want to sort out who's to blame. And a lot of domestic abuse isn't as injurious. It's not as clearly as injurious as we would like. So you don't just look at people and know who the guilty party is.
So you were talking about an egalitarian attitude toward male and female relationships. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So that seems as though that's at the crux a lot of the policy that you're taking issue with right now. How does that, besides the arrest, how does that play out in how domestic abuse is handled, both at the time of the incident and afterwards?
I found a sort of egalitarian attitude. And it's, you know, in research, it's called the symmetry argument, this idea that probably both parties were in conflict and one side might have been, you know, more injurious, but that they're both sort of to blame. And I found that it was pervasive in some psychological approaches, you know, to handling abuse, to, you know, the dual arrests. It's problematic. I called the title of my book is Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? It's this idea like, oh, if you just tell him how it's making you feel, that'll make it better. It's this idea that you could communicate your way out of the situation. So we refuse to see that it's asymmetrical, that there are different power relationships, even within a relationship that appears to be equal, that I think are pervasive in some shelters, in counseling, in policy, and yes, an arrest. But the other part is that what I found is mothers who are attacked are often disproportionately punished. And I guess I could use punished in scare quotes.
Mothers who are. And why would that be?
Right. Well, so some states have adopted what's called failure to protect laws. And these laws are this idea that if you are attacked, assaulted by your partner in front of your children, including even one time you didn't know the attack was coming, that you could be held accountable as a mother for being attacked because you failed to protect your children from that abuse, or you exposed your children to abuse. They witnessed it. And the range of punishments, which might not clearly be punishment in, you know, the legal sense, but what I call punishment is you could be separated from your children under investigation by child welfare, up to like the Tondalo Hall case, if you guys have heard of it, where this woman faces what seems to be a hefty sentence, close to a life sentence for being abused by her boyfriend and her children were attacked, whereas the boyfriend got 2 years.
So what is at the crux of that sentence? Is that she failed in the eyes of the law to protect the children?
Right, and so it's kind of perverse. Like, I think part of the problem is treating relationships as if they're equal, you know, even though we know that there's still unequal political power, unequal economic power, and so on and so forth. But then focusing on the mother as the sort of responsible party, right? She should have left. She should have done something else. And so she becomes the person that the law targets.
We're talking to political scientist Kathleen Arnold right now. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and Katie says that domestic violence is a political issue and not a personal issue. And so you've been outlining some of the issues that you see with the way that domestic violence is handled in this country. What would you like to see change?
Well, one of the things I argue is that the way that we treat refugees, and I do need to qualify this in a second, but the measures we use to determine abuse in other countries that constitutes a human rights abuse is actually a really interesting set of criteria that we could apply to our own country to understand ourselves better. And so there are two really classic cases. They're classic and yet very recent. One is a case from Mexico, and the other case is from Guatemala. And in both cases, it's Department of Homeland Security that oversees, you know, matters of immigration and, you know, refugee policy. They've developed a really interesting way to determine that domestic abuse in these two areas is political. It doesn't mean it didn't happen personally and in the home, but that it's political in several different ways. And I find it ironic that we can see sexism and inequality in these countries and give haven, you know, like we give refuge to these women, and yet we can't do the same thing on our own soil. Instead, the mother could get arrested.
So would that be a matter of different agencies in federal and local governments maybe talking to each other and creating a coherent policy, or what do you think is the holdup?
Honestly, I think that for some reason we think today that if you're in the United States, you're free, so you're free to enter a relationship. No one's holding a gun to your head to get married or just live with someone. And so we assume that women have much more freedom here, I think, than people, for example, women in Guatemala or women in certain parts of Mexico to leave their partners. But the Department of Homeland Security doesn't just look at what the government does or doesn't do. They look at societal beliefs. You know, is there a link between sex and violence? Do we think that some violence or coercion in a relationship is actually part of love? And I think if we looked at our own country, it wouldn't just be the policies. It would be, you know, what's on TV. What kind of message do we give people? Do we actually think abuse is sort of normal? And we don't even call it abuse.
So do you think it's fair to say that the societal interpretation of domestic violence in the United States and the situation specifically that women here are facing is equivalent to some of the other countries that you're referencing there, Guatemala and Mexico, that there is a direct equivalency between the two?
No, I'm not saying the outcomes are the same. What I'm saying is if we applied the same test. So we have a sort of test when you say, okay, you're from Guatemala and you're saying you need to find refuge in the United States. Did you call the police? Do societal beliefs actually, you know, reward abusers? And so I'm saying let's use the same measures. We'll have different outcomes because we can get divorced more easily perhaps in the United States. But at the same time, I don't think women in Guatemala are being jailed for exposing their children to abuse. I don't think they're losing their children because they were abused. So I think we'll find a different picture, but one that's no less sexist and troubling. And even, you know, you got to think, what does this mean about women? What does this mean about our ideas of motherhood? And what does it mean if African Americans and other racial minorities are disproportionately targeted, you know, when this sort of thing happens in the United States?
We're talking to author and political scientist Kathleen Arnold now, talking about her argument that domestic violence is a political issue and not just a personal issue.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What policies would you like to see change to help protect victims of domestic abuse, to help prevent domestic violence? Have you experienced the situation or maybe something in your family? How was that treated by shelters, by authorities? Or have you been someone working at a shelter, or have you been a social worker or law enforcement officer dealing with the domestic violence in this situation? What do we get right? What do we get wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation now about how domestic violence is a political issue and not just a personal one. Kathleen Arnold is our guest. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University and the author of Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know experienced domestic violence? How was that situation treated by a shelter or by law enforcement officers? What policies do you think might have helped? What needs to change to prevent domestic abuse in our policies or in our culture? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, we go to our callers now. We have Cindy joining us first in La Crosse. Cindy, hi.
Hi. My personal experience was that because I did not have proof of the verbal and psychological abuse and different controls that my ex was using on me, my only recourse was to seek divorce and drop my complaints, otherwise risk losing custody of my child, which I was obviously unwilling to do.
So did you choose to do that? You dropped your complaints, Cindy?
I had to. It was that or lose my child.
Cindy, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience with us. And Katie, what strikes you as you hear Cindy's story?
I think that, you know, a couple of things. One is that we think of domestic abuse as just being hitting or just being an assault. And there's a lot of control that goes on. Evan Stark has this great book or a great theory on coercive control, and he's written quite a lot about it. It's really helpful, I think, if your callers want something really good to read. Abuse never happens really in a vacuum, or the sort of abuse that I'm interested in, that's asymmetrical, that's unequal. And so we have to recognize that there are signs of, you know, escalation of inequality that can limit people, that can undermine their parenting, their economic possibilities. So I feel really sympathetic to the sorts of control that, you know, she feels like she went through.
Cindy, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that. And Katie, how did shifting the responsibility to press charges from the victim to the district attorney, how did that change things for domestic abuse victims?
You mean in Wisconsin or?
I believe that's something that you had said, yes.
Shifting responsibility.
So who presses the charges when it comes to domestic abuse?
I mean, it can happen in a range of ways, right? Like, I could go to the police and say that I'm being abused, or there are certain areas in the United States in which district attorneys could take over because they feel that victims are too afraid, for example. From what I know, that doesn't always work just because the other host of sort of like nonprofits and kind of societal beliefs don't really support putting someone behind bars because they assaulted a woman, for example. So I don't think that's going to be the cure-all.
So it hasn't changed enough, in your opinion, when that is the practice?
I would think that's a small change, and it's not misguided or bad. I understand it, but I don't think it's going to change everything, no. When you have such an egregious or such disproportionate blame on women. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, we're going to go back to our callers now. We've got Jana with us in Milwaukee. Jana, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what is your story?
I was listening to what you guys were saying, and actually fairly recently I was thinking about a situation in my family regarding domestic violence. When I was a child, a family member of mine was involved in a domestic violence situation that ultimately led to his girlfriend's death, and he was in prison for that, so... growing up, you know, my family tried to help me see the good in this man and that, you know, you aren't just one action. And ultimately, I ended up myself in a very abusive relationship as a teenager. So it was just kind of an interesting, you know, looking back on it all, it was an interesting position to be in because I see now that I spent a lot of my time trying to find the good in my boyfriend at the time who was, you know, emotionally and physically abusive towards me.
Oh, I think.
Hello?
And.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Jana, sorry, you dropped out a little bit there. I think we lost you, but I think she was getting at some of the family dynamics there and how that can inform, I guess, how we think about things later on. It sounds like she wanted to have a good impression of an earlier family member and then was maybe herself, it sounds like she thought, a little too forgiving later on or accommodating. How complicated is this dynamic when you're talking about families and about these intimate relationships with sort of getting a handle on what's happening?
I think it's important, but I think one of the parts of my book is it's not enough, that we can't think of families, especially who have these sorts of issues that are being replicated, as being self-sustaining. And I don't think that means that people should come in and boss families around or tell them how to live. I don't think that's democratic. But I don't think when people ignore their neighbors or they ignore the abuse that's going on, that they think that it's not their problem. I think as a society, we should feel more obligations to help or say, how can I help you? I think another thing that she was talking about is our society doesn't necessarily take emotional abuse seriously. And I've been thinking about the way that we often ignore PTSD, for example, and how that can kind of influence dynamics in a family. And it's not until violence occurs, including homicide, that people kind of think, oh, I should have recognized that abuse is occurring. But we've had all these signs. We want to compartmentalize between, you know, oh, it's just emotional. You can suck it up, or you can read a book, or you can, you know, you can leave. But very often one, you know, is embedded in the other. Violent acts occur, you know, after emotional abuse or during.
Now, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. What do you want victims and families and support networks to know about things to be aware of and ways to support people who may be affected?
I think one of the things is we really have to think about the degree to which we end up either making a situation equal because we want to be democratic when it's really not equal. And that doesn't mean every single interpersonal conflict doesn't have some, you know, it's possible that there's some equality in a conflict. But when it appears that abuse is occurring, we have to look at it as unequal and think about how you can support someone rather than telling them what to do. The third thing is really shifting our attention to, like, why did Ray Rice feel like he could punch his wife? Why do other people who are abusive, you know, why do they feel legitimized? And I think the answer is because they can get away with it.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Kathleen Arnold. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University, and her latest book is called Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse. We've been talking to her in October, Domestic Abuse Awareness Month. For NFL fans in Wisconsin, it's not hard to guess which team is the favorite, but a new survey from the Harris Poll took that question nationwide to try to figure out the country's best-loved football team.
And the Green Bay Packers are in second place, tied actually with the New England Patriots. In first place, a team that's often called, or used to be called, America's team, the Dallas Cowboys.
And I was not there, Rob, when you received this news, but according to you, you didn't react so well. You reacted poorly.
Yeah, you know, in radio-friendly language, I thought, gosh, really? The Dallas Cowboys? Them? It's, I mean, they're a team, and no offense to our listeners who are Cowboys fans, they're a team I'm happy to see on the air in any random game because I know who I'm going to root against.
So now, why do you think that the Dallas Cowboys came out on top? Trying to take the big picture, do they have better uniforms, or what is it?
It's a long time thing. They used to be a really successful team, and at some point, I guess I don't know the history. I should look more into it. They had this reputation as America's team, even though the Packers clearly should have that title. In fact, should have that reputation.
Well, the survey also asked people what they thought about who would win the Super Bowl this year, and the New England Patriots came out first with 23%, followed by the Seattle Seahawks with 15%, and then we get to the Packers at 13%.
Undefeated, but they're playing two undefeated teams coming up. We'll see what the future holds.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR, and then we'll get some recommendations for great spooky reads for this Halloween. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.